Be still and know that I am God. Be still and know that I am. Be still and know. Be still. Be.
Be still and know that I am God. Be still and know that I am. Be still and know. Be still.
Be.
Be still and know that I am God. Be still and know that I am. Still and know, be still, be.
Well, good morning. Nice to see all of you. I'm Michael Dean. I'm a member of the Word and Life Steering Committee, and it is my great pleasure to introduce a longtime friend of Word and Life, Steve Jacobson. I have always thoroughly enjoyed and benefited from listening to Steve, as his deep spirituality is so rooted in humility, humor, and humanity. Steve had a rich and rewarding career as a Presbyterian pastor, and then moved on to other, and I think you would agree, spiritually related careers with Hospice of Santa Barbara and La Casa de Maria. Since La Casa closed, he has answered several calls to serve as an interim pastor and is currently serving at Summerlin Church. You can read his bio on our website, as well as those of all of our speakers. Steve has authored numerous publications, but I would particularly commend to you his weekly blog, Pocket Epiphanies, and there's a link to it in his bio. Welcome, Steve. And Tim, if you could lead us now in the blessing for our speaker.
We bless you as you share your gifts of spirit and insight. We welcome you with joy.
There we go. Always a joy to be with everybody. I see so many faces that I've been privileged to share my life with in the 30 years we've been in Santa Barbara. I won't call out all the folks that I know, but I felt particularly when I saw Don George this morning. Don, you've been such an influence on my life, trusted counselor, advisor, friend. Just great to see you. And please say, offer my blessings to your wonderful husband. I'm certainly honored to be doing this. I've been following the presentations. Heather, the first opening up all of this with Cynthia, and then Matthew. Oh, he really manifested a wonderful presence. Father Jim, always great. And Marianne, last week that was terrific. I'll never see horses the same way after last week. And I was telling my wife all about it. She used to love horses when she was a kid. I said, I think you've got to get back into horses. I think it'll be a good thing. But what I'm going to do today is I'm going to begin with a little bit of a personal sharing of my encounters with Cynthia Bourgeot. And then I'll go to a little bit of my history of looking for wisdom in my life. And then I'll summarize some key themes in the chapter that I've been assigned. And then I've got several stories from my life that, to me, as I was been in this course and reading the chapter, came to mind. And I hopefully they'll reflect embodiment of Cynthia's themes. So the first time I met Cynthia Bourgeot, I'd heard of her, but she was regularly coming to La Casa thanks to Juliet Spontomi. Juliet said, "You've really got to come and hear Cynthia speak. She's quite remarkable." So I went up to La Casa de Maria, and for those of you who aren't local, La Casa de Maria is an amazing 26-acre sanctuary retreat center that is currently closed. We're working on reopening it, but it's been doing amazing retreats for years. I'll be mentioning it more later in my talk. But I went up to La Casa. It was a Good Friday. Cynthia was there for Holy Week, And I got there a little before, I think it was 11, when she was going to speak. She'd already been there for several days, so the group was kind of milling around. And I was looking at the folks, seeing if I recognized anybody. And I saw this woman who was dressed kind of unusually, kind of something like maybe like a gypsy or something. She had a little crocheted hat and kind of colorful multi-layered garb and everything. And I thought, huh, looks like a different guest. I don't think I recognize her. Well, it came time for 11 and she stepped up and started speaking. And I went, well, that's Cynthia. She was like somebody that I had taken note of because of her unusual presence even before I'd been introduced to her. So I sat and listened to her and she was remarkable and just really got to understand why she was so popular. And then a couple years later, she was coming back to La Casa. And by that time, I'd become co-director with Stephanie Glatt. And so I was going to be there to open the retreat. And we had dinner with Cynthia. And at one point, I said, first time we'd really met. And I said, well, Cynthia, I think maybe give me a little bit of background because I'll be introducing you. And she looked at me and said, you're not going to introduce me. They already know me. They don't know you. You should just introduce yourself because I don't need any introduction. I'm like, okay. So my introduction was very short about myself. And I just said, and here's Cynthia, because she was absolutely right. I will confess that when I read her and listen to her, I kind of feel like I'm soaring with an eagle. I go up with her and I start to see, and I think I'm just so inspired and caught up in what she's saying. But there's moments when I kind of stop and think, where have we been? And I look down and I plummet. It kind of reminds me of Peter walking on water. There's moments when I can't quite follow everything. So I have to go back and read it again. So what I'm doing today is offering you my best sense of when I've been able to soar with her and her thought, where I've been able to grasp what I can, and it's all its richness. So just a word about my own personal journey. I mean, I love this the word wisdom. As a kid growing up, we didn't go to church at all. So it was just a lot of times I'd just be talking with my mother. My mother loved to read. She hadn't ever been to college, but she was into psychic phenomena and spirituality and all kinds of things. But I got to college, UCSB, thinking, oh boy, now I really get to, in fact, I'm going to study philosophy because that's where you find wisdom. And I remember the first day, it was 50 years ago, first day of philosophy 20A, introduction to philosophy. And the professor said, excellence in philosophy is not coming to any truth, but refining your method. I remember thinking, I don't want to have a good method. I want to find truth. But I went through that process. I finished the year-long course and I took other philosophy, but always felt like it was missing, you know? Houston Smith has said, actually heard him speak here in town some years ago, and he was talking about wisdom. And he said, if you go to any research library, major research library, go to the front desk and ask him, where's the wisdom section? And often the librarian probably would have a hard time knowing where to send you. They might send you to philosophy, but I'm not sure if we can find much wisdom there. They might send you to religion if you believe that kind of thing. But wisdom, so prized in the ancient world, it's hard to find sometimes in America. I think of David Brooks, who I think is often wise. And I think Cynthia would resonate with this. David says, our culture often treats us like brains on a stick. Totally disembodied, the analytical, rational, one of those centers that's very critical and helpful in our life. But sometimes that's all we are. We're not this embodied being. So I went off to seminary and went to Princeton Theological Seminary, prided itself on its academic excellence, but it was not an embodied place. It was all up here. It was all cognitive, rational, analytical thinking. It wasn't until I got out and I was ordained that I found a contemplative retreat for the first time ever up in the Bay Area. And I had never been in silence before. I'd never journaled before. I'd never been kind of reverent and quiet walks. And it opened up a whole world, which Cynthia's world, then that became, I didn't know it at the time, but the world that she so richly inhabits and interprets, that was the beginning of my time in that world. And I started going to Benedictine monasteries, which are of course very important to her. So having said all that, I'm going to share with you some of the key things that I've taken from the reading so far in this chapter. And rather than try to use a shared screen in which the speaker becomes a little postage stamp, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, I've reverted to a clipboard here. Let's see, is that legible? Is that legible? What do you think, Judith? No? It was like being at the eye exam. Well, I'll just read them. These are some key themes that I think Cynthia has, for me, resonated so far in the course and then with this chapter. The theme of ora et labora, the theme of prayer and physical labor, manual activity. When she was coming to La Casa, a lot of you have been on retreats, her requirements are we had to screen all of the people who wanted to come, and they had to affirm that they've been already studying her work. They had to affirm that they had a centering prayer practice, and they had to agree that every day they'd be doing some manual labor. And the staff at La Casa, we'd have to figure out, okay, what kind of tasks on our 26 acres can we have that'll be appropriate for Cynthia's participants? And I remember she told me once that requirement was one that was most objected to by people as they were applying. But she said, strangely enough, interestingly enough, at the end of the week, those folks were the ones who said that time of manual labor and silence was actually the most beneficial and surprising thing of the week. So ora et labora. I love her idea that presence is the straight and narrow gate to wisdom. We'll be talking about presence today. Gosh, in ministry, very important. In hospice work is extremely important. I think at La Casa experienced presence many times, many ways. And I love this idea that when that presence comes, it's the straight and narrow gate to wisdom. And that wisdom, when it comes, Cynthia says, is situational. I think the analytical mind, the philosophy mind, likes to freeze dry everything and objectify it and pin it on a wall. But wisdom is so situational. And that's why I think it's so often found in stories. We need to hear stories that contextualize why that was a wise moment. I love the way she puts it, that the natural world resonates with intelligence, not just the rational mind, of course, but the whole natural world has intelligence of all kind. And I think I remember reading, she's a major devotee of Teilhard de Chardin. I think I remember reading that Teilhard himself, growing up in France, he would spend time by a lake and he would just watch the ripples of the lake come, and he would see the stones turning back and forth as they were moving with the lake, and he felt that they were alive. He became a paleontologist, of course, but this idea that is very much taken for granted in indigenous cultures, but is very foreign to modern culture. The whole natural environment is suffused with intelligence and resonates with intelligence. That we live on these realms, there's these intermediary realms, and the awakened heart is capable of perceiving an imaginal world. So something that may not appear in a photograph necessarily, sometimes it does, but the awakened heart can see something as alive and why that's different than it's being not alive. And she has the wonderful story of the snake that Isaac Deanson had admired, and then one of her workers had killed it to give it to her, but the life was out of it. The sheen, it was physically still there, but the aliveness was gone. And I can think of so many times in ministry, at La Casa, and hospice, where you see when people are not alive in that way, and then you see the difference when their aliveness appears. I love what she says when she said the divine is manifested through energies of attention, will, prayer, and love. Attention, will, prayer, and love. Those are ways that we open that narrow gate and find ourselves able to access those things. I love the idea when she talks about the names of God, and she names them love, compassion, strength, steadfastness, mercy, trust, and justice. Those aren't just nice values or properties, and God is some distant, disconnected entity of the prime mover. That's God. When those things are happening, that is the energy, the presence of God in those very things, that we, those names of God. And then when we're experiencing them, when we're able to manifest them, God is fully present. And then I think if, you know, if the one sentence thing, what's the purpose, the meaning of life is to birth the divine, to bring the kingdom of God into our situations, both personally and socially, to be this intermediary between these upper realms and our intermediate realm, and then the imaginal realm, and then bringing it into real life. So all of those to me were very rich. I hope I understood them as she wants us to. But let me now turn to some stories from my own life that embody these. I'm going to start. First story I want to share is happened to me in the 80s. After that early contemplative retreat I'd gone on, I had begun going to Benedictine monasteries, particularly the one, some of you may know it, if you're out from the West, St. Andrew's Priory out near Pear Blossom. And I got to know some of the monks there, Father Vincent Martin, amazing man. And I started regularly going there for silent retreats. I'm a Presbyterian minister. In the Presbyterian training, they don't teach anything about being quiet. In fact, I know a Presbyterian pastor who started doing silent retreats with Presbyterian clergy, and he found it was very difficult. He did one in Montana, where after their third, I think, silent meal, they erupted into a food fight. They just couldn't stand the discipline. If you've been raised Catholic, there's much more respect and cultivation in that silence. But anyway, so one time I went to St. Andrew's Priory, and I've been reading a lot about Catholicism, understanding the contemplative tradition. And I was really curious about Mary. A lot of biblical study in my seminary, nothing about Mary, nothing. And I thought, well, the Catholics think Mary's a big deal. And I wonder what that's like. So I thought, well, I'm here on private retreat. I feel like I want to do some physical labor. Maybe I'll kind of experiment with opening myself to Mary while I do physical labor, that ora et labora. So I went to the guest master that day, and I said, is there some physical labor, a few hours of work? I feel like I want to do something. And he thought, well, yeah, there's actually a part of our hillside kind of washed down. There's a lot of mud and dirt, and we really need somebody to kind of shovel it into a wheelbarrow and transport it to a different part of the property. He says, I don't know if you want to do something like that. And I said, sounds perfect. So I got they showed me the shovel in the wheelbarrow, where they were, and I went over and I saw what my task ahead, and I thought, I'm just going to give this to Mary. I'm going to dedicate this to Mary. I don't even know what that means, but I'm going to start doing it. So I start shoveling into the wheelbarrow, hauling the dirt, dumping it out, coming back. I worked it about 3.5 hours until it was all clear, and I was totally involved in the work. I hadn't really thought about Mary much during. Once in a while, I would see some image of Mary. But I'll tell you, by the time I finished, it was lunchtime. Mary had come to me. I don't know how it worked, but it was so much like that story she tells of the Orthodox priest and the creeds. And Mary just became a part of my inner spiritual life. It wasn't a particular thing I read. It wasn't a particular piece of artwork. I hadn't ever learned. I still haven't learned the rosary or anything else. But she just came into me. And I resonate with Ora et Labora and things that can come to us that aren't going to get here just through the rational mind or just through the feeling. And that connection I've had with Mary has continued. It did almost get me a little trouble once. We were dedicating our new sanctuary in Goleta at the Presbyterian Church in 2001. And it was the second Sunday of Advent, and it was the Annunciation reading. And I loved it. I loved Annunciation every year. And it was taken up. We had a big ceremony, the opening of the sanctuary. And I remember finishing a prayer, and I said, and we pray in the name of Mary. Amen. And then I sat down and I thought, oh no, I wonder if anybody caught that. To this day, nobody's come up and asked me what that was about. And I haven't been reported to the authorities yet, but it felt real to me. And I'll come back to La Casa de Maria, I think, and there's certainly a link there. But for that Benedictine prayer and manual labor thing, that theme, I resonate with it. I want to talk about the power of music. I love music, not a musician. Wish I was, I've tried, don't have it. But so many times I've seen the power of music do convey wisdom. And one time that comes to mind is after 9/11 here in the years following 9/11, there was so much tension with the Muslim community. So I collaborated with my Jewish colleagues in town, Rabbi Cohen and Cantor Mark Childs, and we got to know the Islamic community, and we started to try to do events together, not to talk about politics, but just to connect. And the first one we had was in our little local town here in Goleta, the Goleta Community Center. We picked a neutral ground for it, so we wouldn't be at anybody else's religious building. And we were pondering what to do for a program. And I remember folks that had been in the Parliament of Rural Religion had said, instead of asking representatives of traditions to talk about what they believe, ask them, I mean, in abstract terms, ask them to focus on a particular human problem and what their tradition says about that. So we thought that was a good idea. And we thought, well, okay, let's ask people to reflect on care for the poor. So Father Virgil, a lot of you knew him. He was a wonderful priest here in Santa Barbara, for those of you who aren't local. And he agreed to be one of our speakers. And the imam from the Islamic community, and then Cantor Mark Childs, the gifted singer from the Jewish congregation B'nai B'rith. So we gathered in this space and we had a meal, and it was tense. The only time I had seen people in those days much who were clearly dressed in a Muslim kind of attire, with women with hijabs, men who were Muslim, was on newsreels of terrorism. And at the time, to be in the same room of a lot of people, I think a lot of folks were tense. They're smiling really hard because we wanted to overcome that kind of tension. So Father Virgil got up, he spoke, he did a great job talking about the Franciscan, you know, view and how deep that is in the Franciscan tradition. And the imam spoke. People were a little nervous, but that, you know, it was okay. We got through that. And then Cantor Mark got up. And he just said a few introductory words. He says, I'm just going to sing. And I think what he sang, it was in Hebrew, was the Lord hears the cry of the poor. Blessed be the Lord. But the beauty of that tenor voice in that Jewish cantor musical style, which is like this plea, you know, and it's so close to Islamic call for prayer. When Mark started singing, and that his voice just permeated, the energy changed in that room. And I could feel not only my own talk about, you know, the way we can sense things when we're in this state, the tension in the room dropped and the hearts opened, and there was something alive and not staged and just beautiful in Mark singing that. He didn't even need to say much what the words meant. That resonant power music beautifully sung was the highlight of the evening. I think about, you know, Soren Kierkegaard in Denmark. He was very critical of the official Lutheran Church. He was quite a rebel, and he had wrote about how you can go to this big state Lutheran church, and it's a beautiful building, and they have great music, and they have esteemed preachers. But it doesn't feel spiritual to him. He said it felt aesthetic, where everything is beautiful and well-arranged and flawlessly done, but it just didn't feel like it was coming from an open heart. Just to pause for a minute, and there's a Jewish story about someone asking a rabbi, Rabbi, why does it say that the Lord placed the Torah on our heart? Why not in our heart? And the rabbi says, the Lord placed the Torah on our hearts, so when our hearts break open, the Torah will fall in. And I always remember that. And I think what Kierkegaard was saying is that we can have a heart and we can do beautiful things, but if it comes to really come to be spiritual for me, to be spiritual, it's coming from a place deep within, which is a place of great humility and love and adoration. And what Kierkegaard said, getting back to Kierkegaard, is that when the spiritual comes where the aesthetic is, it doesn't negate the aesthetic, it just dethrones it. So the aesthetic experiences of art and music become servants to the spiritual. That's what Mark did that night, I think. And I think a lot of us encourage you in your groups if you've had moments like that. And I'll just say right now, I'm at this little church in Summerlin, this little small congregation. They have an incredible music ministry, very rich. It's very much praise song based, which is not my, hasn't been my preferred way of communicating. But the woman and the musicians do it so well that I, again and again, I find my heart just opening up to that, and that spiritual presence coming. And I think that's what Cynthia is talking about, these different modes that get it out of here and get it into the awakened heart, and it's transformative. Let me tell you a story from hospice. I was director here at Hospice of Santa Barbara 5.5 years, and we saw several hundred folks every month. Some of them were anticipating mortality, anticipating dying. Many of them were in grief therapy, grief work, following the loss of children, parents, spouses, loved ones of all kinds. So it was very intentionally a healing place. And our motto was compassionate care freely given. Compassion's one of those names of God for Cynthia, I think. And so our staff, when we hired people, we wanted the best professional folks, the marriage and family therapists, social workers, different folks. But we were really looking for their heart too, that they were not only had the skills of a professional, but they had the heart. And we were very blessed that a number of folks in town became volunteers who were Reiki, healing touch, massage therapists, cranial sacral folks. We call that complementary therapies. And this is very much, I think, going to what Cynthia is talking about in terms of incarnating and physically doing, opening to the present divine presence. So people were offered, they would come and they'd be seeing a counselor for so-called talk therapy. They'd also be offered, if you'd like, you can have several sessions of complementary therapy, if you wish, of any of these modalities. And so often people would, and as you can imagine, people would say that, some client would come and maybe it was a Reiki session and the person was engaged. And as that person began to feel themselves physically embodied again, they had a lot of sorrow and grief, and there'd just be a lot of weeping. And the person carrying there would just continue the work and allow that to happen. With those names of God, of love, compassion, mercy, trust, those things were embodied silently in what those folks were doing. And some folks would say, just kind of like my experience with Mary, that they would walk away and they don't know what happened to them. They had their talk session and then they had their complementary therapy, but they would feel different. They would feel cleansed. Sometimes they would feel more alive. And a story that really sticks out to me is from one of the massage therapists. There was a homeless gentleman who came for our services, and he came up to the office up in the Riviera here in Santa Barbara. And so he was kind of reluctant, not quite sure about it, but he agreed to have a massage treatment. And so the massage therapist said, talked to him a little bit, helped him be comfortable, and said, you're perfectly welcome to whatever clothing you want to keep on or not. It's up to you, whatever you're comfortable with, because I'm not taking off anything. So they said, fine. So he got on the table face down, including his fully clothed with socks and shoes, the first time. And the therapist just went with that, of course, and just worked with him very carefully, kind of attuning herself to him. And the next week he came back and he said, well, I've decided I'm going to take off my shoes and socks. So on the second visit, he took off his shoes and socks. And so she just cared for him for that 50 minutes. And so he had one more session, and that was the third one. And he said, well, I've decided I'm going to take my shirt off for this one. he took his shirt off and she did her work. And when he was done, he put the shirt back on and he said, "That's the first time in my life anybody's touched my back with any caring touch." Now, Cynthia talks about attention, intention, manifesting those things. He died about 2 weeks later. And imagine going your whole life and never have had that kind of touch. And thanks to the work that our staff did, he felt at least that once in his life, somebody had done that for him. So my last stop on the tour is La Casa de Maria. And I know this group has just expanded wonderfully across the country and internationally. All you local folks, a lot of you know La Casa de Maria. And I'll just say before I tell a few stories that after the mud flow 4 years ago, it's been a long period of just kind of sitting there. Some other things had to get worked out. But since January, there's been a group of us, Stephanie Glatt and Juliet Spontomi, who are part of Word and Life here, Mary Becker, who's known to some of you local folks, and myself and a couple other consultants. We've been working towards the reopening of La Casa. And we're hoping that maybe next month we'll be able to go to the county. We've got some great plans, high hopes, but it's a remarkable place. So again, for those of you who aren't there, 26 acres out in Montecito, beautiful setting, oaks everywhere, creek coming through. Originally a manor house and a manor for a wealthy family. In the 40s, it became a Catholic novitiate for the Immaculate Heart of Mary women. In 1970, that group split off from the Catholic Church and became an independent spiritual order. And since then, it's flourished with every group imaginable. Thich Nhat Hanh has been there, Sai Baba, all kinds of Catholic, Protestant, Buddhist teachers, people, nonprofits, people of all kinds, lots of recovery groups. It's just an amazing place, a healing place. And here's a few stories that that to me reflect that there's something there. Last Saturday, I was at a fundraiser in town for the rescue mission here. I happened to see one of the consultants we've been working with at La Casa. He's helping us manage the county and all the requirements. And he introduced me to his wife. And she said, "Oh, you're part of the La Casa group." And I said, "Yes, I am." She goes, "Oh, well, you've got to save that place." And I said, "Well, we're working on it. Your husband's really helping us. But what does it mean to you? You know, did you go there?" She goes, "Oh, yeah, I went to a retreat there." I said, "Well, what kind of retreat was it?" She goes, "I don't remember what the retreat was." She says, "What I remember is that I was really tired and stressed out. We had a 3-month-old. It had been a very difficult time. Lots was going on in our life. And I got to this retreat. I was able to get away for one day. And I found the women's room. And I went in and I just cried for 35 minutes. Because I couldn't even see any. I just needed to let all that stress out. And then I kind of composed myself and I just walked the grounds. And by the time I walked the grounds, I felt like a new person. There's something there at that place. There's a presence there. It's been immersed in contemplation and prayer and healing and courage creating events for 50 years and more, 70 years. And there's something in that ground. Now, can you imagine going to a hotel and being in the bathroom 35 minutes and walking around the hotel and feeling renewed? I mean, maybe it happens, but it happened for her. Another story. At this beautiful, La Casa, there's a beautiful stone manor house. Catherine Collis, who's part of Word and Life, she was a terrific spiritual director there and involved there many years. Others of you may know it, but it's just this beautiful house that's been really wonderfully preserved, the architecture, the spirit of it. You can come and stay maybe a dozen people in that house or so, and there's meals served every day. There's times of quiet, times of conversation at the table. People come and they get the idea while they're staying there for a few days that they'll create their own environment, and there's all these wonderful opportunities to do that. But there is much of it's about self-discovery, about just quieting down, getting away from televisions, all the news, all the media, all the devices, just grounding, resting, weeping if that's what's needed, having good food, being in, you know, walking, chit-chatting if that's right. An incredible number of things happened there in that simple, beautiful space. Just one came to mind this week as I was thinking about it. Catherine was the resident spiritual director there, and there were days when Catherine was away or other spiritual folks weren't available. So once in a while, they called me. I was mostly the administrative, but since I'd been a pastor, you know, and if I could, I'd say, and I would help if I could. So one day, one of the staff called and said, there's a woman here who really like to talk, to have a spiritual direction session. Can you come? And I thought, sure. So I went up. I met her, an older woman who had terminal cancer. And we went up to the second story where there was the spiritual direction room right next to the little chapel. And we sat down and kind of got to chat a little bit. And then I said, well, tell me, you know, what is it? And she said that she'd come here to really find her way through her illness. But the previous night, she'd been at dinner and she'd been choosing to have her meals in silence. And she was bringing her plate back to the table and she tripped. And she fell and her plate hit the ground. And she said it was very embarrassing, but she felt as if something evil had caused that. And she was quite haunted by that feeling. So I looked at her, kind of, you know, trying to open and be aware of things seen and unseen. And I said, do you have a religious background? And she said she did, that she'd been a Catholic from a young age. And I said, well, tell me more about that. And she said, well, my parents weren't religious at all, but at age 7, one day I just really felt the need that I wanted to go to the Catholic Church. And I went and I was welcomed and I became a part of that, even though my parents didn't know why I was wasting my time doing that. But that's been a part of my life all the time. So I looked at her and I said, God claimed you as a 7-year-old, called you, and you belong to God, and nothing can touch you. You've come to this safe place to know that. And her face, which had expressed a lot of fear, wasn't a bit dramatic, but you could see aliveness coming back to it. When she felt from the inside out that truth that she'd been called to know as a child. That wouldn't happen in a hotel. La Casa is a thin space. Cynthia loves La Casa. We're hoping to get her there when we reopen it, be there often. But I want to stick with young children just for a sec. We had a chef, assistant chef hired there to be in that stone house. And she was there after a couple of weeks and I got to know her a little bit. I dropped by to see how things were going. And she mentioned she had a couple of kids. So I dropped by one time and I said, well, how's it going? She goes, oh, great. I love working here. I said, how are your kids? She goes, well, I've got to tell you an interesting story. She goes, I decided this weekend to bring my kids to see where mom works. And I've got a 7-year-old daughter and a 4-year-old son. And my 7-year-old daughter is just a very well-mannered, very respectful person. My 4-year-old is just a piece of work. He's just always getting into trouble, always restless, always trying to make trouble. And so I brought my daughter and my 4-year-old son and then one of the cousins who was staying with us. And the whole way we're driving up to La Casa, the two guys in the back are just needling each other and kind of trying to calm them down. We drive through the gate of La Casa, and I don't say a word, she said. And in the back seat, they calmed down. And each of them turned and started looking out the window. And they were silent as she drove around the whole route around La Casa. And they said, is this where you work, Mom? And she said, yeah. And they were quiet. And then as soon as they got out in the gate and started going home, they started going after each other again in the back seat. They felt it. Kids can feel this, what Cynthia is talking about, this presence, this love, this compassion. And I'm going to ask you during the groups, you know, when have you felt that? Are there places where you feel, are there things that you do that manifest that? We were very thankful just before we had to close La Casa for all the nonprofit groups that were coming. We had a group called Courage to Lead based on Parker Palmer's things. Hundreds of nonprofit leaders have come through there. And a lot of it is doing, it's not religious curriculum, but it's very much what Cynthia is talking about, of being in nature, learning to observe, sensing that intermediate realm that we live in, naturally rising up within us when we're alone and with people we can trust and in a sacred grounds, the importance of compassion and justice and strength and courage. And those things can come to us anywhere. Cynthia's work really helps give me language in my own mind to interpret some of these experiences I've had in my life. And she's amazing that way doing it. She reminds us that we're not brains on a stick, that we're embodied beings, that we have this intermediate role of sensing and being open to the divine and helping that incarnate in space and time. And when we find ourselves doing that individually or in groups, then I think we found the human purpose. So I think I sent Tim a couple of questions. Just encourage you in your small groups, anything that I've said today, if that evokes anything, just experiences that you can share with each other where you've had similar things that I as to what I described. So thanks.
Steve, would you like to read these in the chat and invite us to a conversation today?
Absolutely. What practices of labora et, What practices of ora et labora, which is labora, ora labora, prayer, contemplation, labora, physical activity, lots of kinds of physical activity. What practices of those have helped you discover the divine purpose at moments in your life? So what contemplative, prayerful, physical activities will you find yourself getting open to this, to the divine? And then going beyond the just individual, have you had experiences in a group or community where you've experienced the arising of presence and divine purpose? Groups you've been in, small groups perhaps, support groups, congregations, communities. Have you had those experiences that Cynthia talks about in those kinds of places? But go where the spirit leads. Those are just meant to be an opening for you all in the small group. So blessings on you.